Okay, so the actual title is Controlling X-ray and XUV Raman Transitions Using Krotov Numerical Optimization. And so I'm Lauren Greenman. I'm a postdoc at Berkeley with Brigitte Whaley, who's not here right now, but whose birthday it is today. So this is a talk kind of honoring her birthday. So first I'll talk a bit about controlling light-matter interactions in the strong field and ultrafast limit. Especially with regards to electronic structure. Yeah?
So I'm waiting for Hiran to make his replies.
Sure, sure.
Right. No, I mean, you can stop.
You can stop and go back then, I
okay,
guess.
Yeah, I'll stop and go back. So then I'll talk about the time-dependent configuration interaction singles method for dynamics in this regime, the TDCIS method, which we developed, and I'll talk about that. And then I'll talk about using the Krotov optimization procedure with these TDCIS equations for motion, and I'll present some preliminary results for doing X-ray Raman in NEON. So to control the light-matter interaction in the strong field, there's kind of there's a few different parts to it. The first of which would be the control of the actual light fields. What kind of control fields can we use? Basically, with infrared fields, we could use gratings to create a number of pulses.
Oh.
Yeah, I didn't sing because I'm being mic'd, so otherwise. So control of the light fields. In the infrared, basically I assume that you could have control of the light field, of the shape of the pulse envelope completely. For higher energy fields, pulse shaping is in its early stages. There was a talk at the quantum control conference by Eleftherios Giuliamakis about controlling in the higher energy regimes, which you could do within a larger bandwidth, but it's definitely in its early stages. You could do control the complex envelope phase, basically where the oscillations occur within the envelope of the control field, and this is something we could take advantage of for numerical optimization calculations. And then you could use high harmonic generation to generate these high energy photons. But the intensity of the photons, especially in tabletop experiments, is limited. And so multi-photon processes, the likes of which I'm going to talk about in this talk, can be difficult at certain intensities. So the matter part of the light-matter interaction, the electronic structure, especially in the strong field regime, is a difficult task. Perturbation theory, which has been applied for control in lower energy regimes, generally fails for processes in the higher energy, especially for processes like high harmonic generation, in which many infrared photons are absorbed in the first step. Models which describe strong field processes using a single active electron approach, as you heard in the previous talk, are fairly widespread, but we're just starting to look at what happens when you go beyond the single active electron approach. The method that I use, the time-dependent CI singles method, is kind of a first step beyond the single active electron approach, and I'll talk about the details of the method later in the talk. And this describes basically coupling between ionization channels. And then I'll talk a bit later too about what it doesn't describe, but basically it misses a lot of correlation between electrons. And for this, full calculations using methods like a multi-configurational time-dependent Hartree-Fock are extremely expensive. And then for all of these, there's the added issue that a grid-based method is generally required for a strong field problem because you're ionizing atoms and molecules, and you need to describe the actions of the electrons far from, the ionized electrons that travel far from the atoms and molecules. And traditional electronic structure using Gaussian type orbitals fall off far too quickly to describe this. And then there's the issue of coupled atomic and nuclear motion. So vibonic coupling is present, and in many cases, the most interesting experiments are exploiting the coupling between electronic and nuclear degrees of freedom. Conical intersections, as you heard a little bit about in the previous talk, can be explored and used. And then what I'll talk about in this talk, but I won't describe any vibrational nuclear electronic coupling in this talk, but you could use these high energy photons to impart momentum kicks to atoms and molecules. And so for these sorts of calculations, the level of expense goes up even another degree. You might need to solve the full time dependent Schrodinger equation for coupled nuclear and electronic degrees of freedom in many cases. But what we're interested in is going kind of a step beyond what's been done so far and moving to extreme UV and X-ray nonlinear spectroscopies. So there are the X-rays give you the advantage that they address these atomic core states, and so they give you a localized probe of electronic dynamics in a molecule. But and then you could use nonlinear processes using two different X-rays. The difference of energy now corresponds to a valence excitation in an atom or in a molecule especially. And then that way you could address these valence excitations, which are the excitations of interest in most chemical processes, using the localized X-ray or strong field pulses. And so the kind of big picture in the long run scheme would be to have a long chain molecule with different atomic species at each end of the chain, and then use a sort of three-wave mixing. So you pump on one end of the chain with one set of atomically specific pulses, and then you probe on the other end of the chain. And then that way you could determine electronic transfer in a localized manner. So that's the kind of big picture, but the experiments that we're interested in right now are doing Raman now, and not in the X-ray, but in the XUV regime with lithium or neon. So in the example of lithium, you would excite, you have a ground state configuration of 1s2, 2s. You would excite that 1s electron up to a 3p level, and then you would let the 3p fall to a 4s or to a 2s level. And so you've created a valence excitation in lithium using these X-rays. And in neon, you have a ground state of 1s2, 2s2, 2p6. You excite a 2s electron up into a 3p, and then come back down. You fill that 2s hole with the 2p electron. So you've created a valence excitation from a 2p to a 3p, but you've gone through this localized state. So this is the kind of basic building block that you need to make these nonlinear spectroscopies possible. And there's a couple of problems. The main problem is that you can see these dotted lines, those are the ionization limits of each of these atoms. And so each of these X-ray pulses is bringing you well into the ionization continuum. So you need to be able to describe in any control methods how the ionization happens in addition to how all the processes that are happening within the molecule. And then also, for many wave mixing experiments, you want coherence created between your original state and your excited states. And so this is also something for which coherent control would be useful.
So your excited state's in the continuum, right?
The intermediate state is in the continuum. The event, the final excited state is below the continuum.
So is the idea then to be off resonance so that you don't do directly coupling?
So at first, we do on resonance calculations, and But there's, yeah, you definitely could go off residence and do schemes like that, but we haven't looked at that yet. It's all, but the idea, I mean, the idea is to, so there's multiple ideas. I'll kind of get ahead of myself now. One is to use kind of, use an infrared pulse in addition to these X-ray pulse to couple the states in the continuum. And this way you could use the bandwidth of the X-ray pulse to do like a two-path way interference type thing. So this is kind of the starting point that we took. But yeah, you could definitely play with detuning the pulses. So then the other thing to notice here, especially for lithium, which is light, the X-ray pulses will, or sorry, the XUV pulses will impart significant momentum to the lithium. And for the experiments, this is pretty unique and useful. You could use this large momentum kick to detect the lithium in the excited state. And you do this through a matter interferometry detection scheme. Holger Mueller at Berkeley is working with us to develop these sorts of schemes. But basically, when you hit the lithium with the X-ray pulse, the part that's put into the excited state, the matter wave actually splits because of the momentum absorbed. And so you have you could use matter interferometry techniques to detect this, and then you could think of going past that even to do multiple pulses and then look at the basically like an echo with the matter waves that so you could split them at one point and then do the opposite momentum and then you get an echo of the matter waves. So in molecules, such momentum kicks could be used to prepare specific vibrational wave packets or to probe conical intersections. So this is sort of where things are headed. But first we want to see if we can even do the single Raman transition in the first place. So I'm going to step back a bit and talk about a method that we developed to probe effects beyond the single electron effects in high harmonic generation. And this method describes ionization using a potential, a complex absorbing potential. And so it was a method that's well suited to describing the X-ray Raman process, in which ionization is an important part that we wanted to look at.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So I just want to understand. I mean, this 49 harmonics and 49 photons together. So this is how probability, what's the probability to get there? So in the sense, you're always in perturbation regime with respect to field?
We're going to describe it using this TDCIS method, which isn't a perturbation theory method, but I would suspect that you might be in a perturbation regime for, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself. The real answer is I don't know. We're using the 49th harmonic. It's one photon.
It's an XUV pulse.
Yeah, I understand, but how strong is it, so how, what is the probability?
You'll see that in some of the results, right?
So can I just ask, this is a naive question for, in the sense that it's asking about theory, but I'm an experimentalist, so I don't know some of the basics. But from what you just described, it's already beyond the single active electron approximation because the intermediate state has a different electron configuration than the final state with more than one electron. More than one electron has changed. And on the other hand, I can just use, I mean, it's just atoms. I can just use simple Hartree-Fock wave functions, and it'd be really easy to do a calculation. It's not a big deal to do a calculation. So where does this sophistication then come from?
So I'm not sure I understand what you mean by we could just do Hartree-Fock.
If I needed to calculate it, I think even I or my students could calculate the dipole matrix element that couples, that's coupled by the field and the two, in all the arrows that you drew there.
How are you describing the excited state? I mean, it's in the continuum.
I'm not describing the continuum, but you didn't describe the continuum either.
No, he is.
I will describe the continuum, but even without the continuum, I mean, it's basically, I think you'll see pretty much what we do. It's a calculation where you do kind of a Hartree-Fock calculation and then describe the simplest version of an excited state using those Hartree-Fock orbitals. So I think the answer is that is pretty much what we do.
But you stop. It's where you start, I think. I mean, it doesn't look like
yeah, I mean, I'll get into the details, and then maybe you could ask your question again, because... Okay, so to go over the three-step single-active electron model of high harmonic generation, first you have tunnel ionization, in which the field kind of bends your atomic potential, allowing ionization of the electron. The electron then propagates in your laser field. Depending on where in the laser field it releases, it will take a different path before recolliding with the parent ion, and this is where this recombination is where you get your high harmonics. So one problem with the single active electron model, it describes the cutoff of your high harmonics very well, but it doesn't necessarily describe the scaling of the high harmonics with respect to the size of the noble gas that you get them from. So the question is this because single active electron approach isn't enough? And we try to answer that. So you need to include coupling between different ionization channels. And the simplest method to do so is to describe these as single electron excitations from some ground state, which is actually accurate for most atoms. So maybe this answers kind of what you're thinking. So you take a ground state and you build a wave function that is a linear combination with time-dependent coefficients of that ground state plus excitations from occupied orbitals to unoccupied orbitals. So it's basically Hartree-Fock for excited states. It's slightly different from what time-dependent Hartree-Fock in that our orbitals are not time-dependent and our coefficients are time-dependent. So, but it's a detail.
So can you just clarify, you say in the first thing that you include coupling between ionization channels. So the phi IAs there are, those are bound orbitals, or those are also?
The I is the bound orbital,
yeah.
And then the A is an unbound orbital. It's a virtual orbital. And so the coupling comes between the different I, an I and a J. So you'll get a Hamiltonian matrix element that is a Coulomb interaction between an I and a J, and this will give you coupling between different holes in the parent ion.
So you're discretizing the continuum, and that's, the A is a discrete index?
Yeah, the A is a discrete index. So the way we deal with the way we deal with the continuum is by adding, at a cutoff, radius, we add a potential that is zero before that radius and that is complex after it, harmonic complex potential. And so the A orbitals will have some imaginary part to their energies, and this will cause dissipation.
I still don't understand what the notation phi IA. This is your basis, right?
Right. So the phi naught is your n lowest energy orbitals, okay? And then in that calculation that gives you those lowest energy orbitals, you also get this set of unoccupied orbitals, higher energy orbitals. And so the IA notation would say I is part of that set of n occupied orbitals, and A is part of the set of unoccupied orbitals. So these phi IA states are n particle anti-symmetric tensor products that instead of having the ith orbital that phi naught has, they have the eighth unoccupied orbital instead. Okay. So how do you get those occupied orbitals? You do a Hartree-Fock calculation. you build the fine knot as I said, an anti-symmetric tensor product of n orbitals, and you minimize the energy of that tensor product with respect to the shape of the orbitals. So you build your orbitals on a grid, and you add the complex absorbing potential, as I just mentioned, to capture the ionized wave packet. As a technical note, including that in this step, instead of the time-dependent step, reduces your numerical error, but kind of makes the time-dependent calculation more difficult, because you are now, your phi IA states are orthogonal with respect to a symmetric product and not a Hermitian product, meaning just don't conjugate the phi IA when you write that bra. But for any expectation values, which are Hermitian expectation values, you need a Hermitian and a symmetric interproduct. So what does this electronic structure describe? In electronic structure theory, we talk about correlation as anything that's kind of above a mean field level. So exchange correlation is kind of included in your Hartree-Fock, but when we say electron correlation, we mean things that are beyond Hartree-Fock. And there's kind of two different kinds of correlation in electronic structure. Dynamic correlation, which can be thought of as due to the instantaneous Coulomb interactions between electrons, and this leads to, you generally think of a quantitative error, not qualitative errors, and then static or multi-reference correlation, which would be due to your ground state wave function needing to be described not just by one anti-symmetric tensor product, but by multiple. For instance, if you have this ring that you talked about in your talk, when you open the ring, you generally have multiple, you need to describe both the left side of the ring and the right side of the ring kind of with separate wave functions. And so this is another source of electron correlation, and this generally leads, I wrote quantitative, but I mean this sort of correlation leads to qualitative errors. So TDCIS method captures channel coupling. It captures the first step beyond a single active electron model, but otherwise it misses correlations due to the Coulomb forces. It misses pretty much both dynamic correlation and static correlation. For atoms, this tends not to be a problem. We're probably going to get some numbers wrong due to the dynamic correlation, but static correlation doesn't tend to be a big problem in atoms. But when we move on to molecules, especially for non-equilibrium geometries, and double especially near conical intersections, static correlation is extremely important. And so you need to do a multi-configurational calculation, which gets very expensive, especially with these grid methods. I'll skip over the equations of motion in the interest of time and move on to some results. So we use the TDCIS method to describe the high harmonic generation of argon. At the top, so just pay attention to the top for now. You have the interchannel means all Coulomb interactions turned on, and then you have a red curve which has the 3s and 3p orbitals of argon active, and the green curve which has the 3p zero orbital active. So the green curve is basically a single active electron approach. Here you have the high harmonic generation spectrum, and it matches okay at the end and okay at the beginning, but there's definitely a region in the middle where you are drastically underestimating the intensity of your harmonics. Also, if you look at 1 minus rho naught, 1 minus the population of the ground state, you see that the single active electron model, again, underestimates the underestimates the size of the hole that you're creating in your molecule. So channel coupling is definitely affecting the hole populations and the position. Oh, also the position of the Cooper minimum. So the minimum of the high harmonic spectra is also affected by using the single active electron approximation.
So when I say that 1 minus rho zero, it's kind of proportion which you excite.
Right. It's the hole population. So then this is exactly what you were seeing in the experiments, is that the intensities are being underestimate.
If you can do perturbation theory with respect to fuel.
Oh, definitely not in the case of high harmonic generation.
I know, so the population is not excited. Respect to fuel, I mean. No, I mean. Not analyzing the high harmonic generation, but analyzing how much you're excited on your cellular system. Mm-hmm. I believe that's what you have.
I'm not sure I understand.
So most of the population stay in the bound states, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it means that the probability to get excited for the electron is 10%.
Yeah.
So the perturbation theory is directly field should work perfectly well. If I write all equations which you wrote and do the perturbation theory with respect to field, so second order perturbation should give me good results as well.
As far as how much is ionized, not as far as what the high harmonics that are produced.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. So we also looked at the photoionization of xenon with the TDCIS method. And so here what I'm showing is the this axis is a measure of the coherence between the 4D0 and the 5S holes in xenon. And this axis is the width of the pulse and time. And this is a time axis for the propagation. And what you could see is that there's coupling between ionization channels that entangle the ion and the photoelectron. So the electron that you're exciting off of the atom is talking back to the atom. And if you try and if you use too large of a bandwidth of a pulse, you end up causing these oscillations in the coherence between the channels. So a few other TDCIS calculations that have been done. The out of second transient absorption of krypton, in which the TDCIS method was extended to spin orbit coupling. This was used to describe some results in this paper, in which Eleftherios Goulimakis was able to shape X-ray pulses. And then also the nonlinear response of highly ionized neon to ultrafast X-rays. So, okay. So what we wanted to do was combine this with a numerical optimization scheme. And then to do so, we have to pick a cost functional. And so the cost functional that we picked to start out with is the real part of the symmetric overlap between the specific Raman state that we're interested in and our wave function. Okay, so this isn't necessarily the best choice of functional, but because, as I will show you in a minute, the Raman process is very low probability process, this is sort of numerically an optimal choice to begin our calculation. We could also do state-to-state transfer, which would be the Hermitian overlap between the Raman state and the wave function, that absolute value squared. And we could also explicitly minimize ionization by considering the norm, a cost function norm of the wave function. Ask your question again. Right. So this is the real part of the desired state of the phi IA, and this is the imaginary part. And this beta and gamma, so I skipped over in the interest of time the equations of motion. But alpha are the coefficients on the ground state and the excited state wave functions. And they have a real and imaginary part. And the real and imaginary part are beta and gamma. Sorry. So basically, this is just a way of writing the overlap between the state that you want and the state that you have.
You have gamma, so it means that your Hamiltonian is, let's say, as imaginary part, right?
Right. So beta is the real part of it, and...
Yeah, there's an open system where you have just the coherence there. You include gammas there. So you have... It's open system or just closed system? So this is a question.
It's closed in that we are... The ionization is taken into account as the part of the wave function that moves into the imaginary space. So we're not kind of losing any information, but we're describing the ionization using kind of the complex parameters. Okay. So again, in the interest of time, I'll skip the derivation. But the kind of main point is that the Krotov numerical optimization is a monotonically decreasing optimization in your cost functional. That you basically you have a set of like a dual wave function chi's that you set to be your desired state at the beginning. You propagate with the negative of the equations of motion of your wave function, and you get an update formula that is an overlap between your dual wave function. This mu is the part of the Hamiltonian that comes from the electric field interaction, so it's basically the dipole elements, and then your alpha, that's the wave function.
The equation for the field, optimal field, right?
Right, that's the equation for the optimal field.
So it doesn't have gammas?
They're in here, they're in the alpha. Alpha includes beta and gamma. Okay. So here is the two XUV photon pulse for the neon Raman. This is the pulse as a function of time. And here are the results from the TDCIS method. These different lines are the different holes that you create in neon. The 2S hole is in blue, the 2P1 hole is in green, and the 2P-1 hole would be right, would be the same thing because it's linear polarized light. And then in red is the 2P0 hole.
Well, if you represented that as, if you wrote that as a linear distribution instead of just E of T, would it look interesting? I mean, I'm just wondering about things like counterintuitive order and that kind of stuff.
Right, so I'll get to that. So this light blue line that you could barely see stuck there at 5 × 10⁻⁷ is the population of your desired state. So it's a very low probability to get your Raman pulse just for this naive choice of ordering of the pulses and things of that nature.
That's a question on the time scale that you've got.
This is a very short pulse. These are two like femtosecond pulses.
So my question is related to that, which is, what is the time scale for auto-ionization?
So I've calculated it using rate equation theory, and it's basically negligible on this time scale.
It's very long.
So. Yes. And that's why these states were chosen. Okay. Just a quick technical note. So these are Hartree-Fock-Slater potentials, which are one electron calculations. Basically, instead of minimizing a Slater determinant, we just pick one electron potential. And what that means is that we're turning off coupling between channels, basically, to make our control calculations simpler. And then once we have our control fields, we'll turn them back on and see what difference it makes. So compared to the whole populations, our Raman state is very small. And now here's a comparison between the optimized pulse data in red and what I just showed you in blue. So the pulses themselves, in blue is the original pulse, and then in red, so a couple things to note. Obviously, it's stretched the pulse out and as far as we'd let it, basically narrowing the bandwidth, which makes sense, narrowing the bandwidth is going to give you your Raman state more. And to the question of counterintuitive order, it does look, although I haven't done like a full analysis, but it does look, these are really preliminary results, that it's kind of changing the order of the pulses. It's stretching it out, and it's also changing the frequency of the oscillations over here versus over here. But I think, I don't know for a fact, but I think it's doing it in the intuitive order.
You have one pulse, what do you mean?
Of the two colors in the pulse. So if you look at a Fourier transform of that pulse, you'll see in the blue, you have the two colors that I originally talked about. And then in the red, so it has sharpened the bandwidth significantly of those colors, but it's also added the sort of region in the infrared, and to a smaller extent, these regions at higher energies. Now,
are those important?
I don't know is the answer. I need, again, these are very preliminary results, and so I need to do more analysis on these pulses. I'm not sure if these infrared photons are creating two pathway interferences, but it's definitely a possibility, and more on that in the future. So what does this do? This is the desired state overlap, and blue is the original pulse, and red is the optimized pulse. You get about a couple orders of magnitude by going from the original pulse to the optimized pulse. And then if you normalize that by the maximum amount of ionization, you still see that for free, we're getting an order of magnitude, or close to two even, by using the numerical optimization. Okay. And so that's just I stopped it after a certain order of magnitude. It could go even further. It's kind of hard to see, but there's this is a Fourier transform of the different fields. The blue and the red are the same as before, but now there's green kind of pulse, and it's changed the shape of the IR a little bit. But it's basically maintained the same structure, and get another couple orders of magnitude from another, you know, letting the optimization go longer. But so now, due to extra ionization, it starts to introduce numerical errors into my calculations. So probably going to need to think about the cost functionals that I'm using and not have such a simple one.
What's the 20 dB? There's a state there?
Yeah, so these are the blue, the 20 and 40, those are the two colors that give you, so the 40 is the top transition and the 20 is back down.
What's the relative energy in all of those?
Say that again?
What's the relative energy in all of those three strings?
It's all the same. I'm not sure I understand the question. But...
The field energy.
Well, do each of those pulses have exactly the same total energy?
Yes.
That was one of your constraints.
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't understand. No. There is an increase in energy of the field, but the increase in energy is minimized. So it's not constrained to be the same, but it's minimized. But if you look.
And what is it for those three cases?
I don't have the numbers, but if you just kind of look at the intensities of the pulses, the maximum intensities aren't increasing by a whole lot from one to another.
You have some kind of penalty on the fluence of the field.
Mm-hmm.
So what that tends to do is to not favor counterintuitive ordering.
Now, okay.
Counterintuitive ordering has the advantage that it's robust with respect to the amplitude as well, but it also generally costs a lot more in terms of energy.
Okay.
Therefore, if you put in a penalty on the energy, you tend to do a favor against that kind of mechanism. So it's one of the... What is it?
No, I would say you would favor a resonant transition, but it would remove off-resonant. But in terms of orders, it should not be, at least in my case.
Well, if you have a penalty, I suppose, I think you would need a stronger field for the Raman net transition.
Well, you will move to the resonance, which just gives you less energy.
Mm-hmm. That's true. So, but if there is a resonant pathway, then the optimization would favor this because there should be much lower energy than if you have the off resonant. Maybe you have chosen the penalty such that you want low-energy solution.
Complete sequence, it's not about this.
Exactly, we need to choose a penalty very carefully if we want to apply it to industry.
If you do an intuitive pulse sequence, then we can do essentially a pi pulse followed by another pi pulse.
Sequential.
But if you do a counterintuitive, then you typically need, you know, something on the order of 10 pi or several pi.
Yeah, that's why you can play with the number on the 10.
You can play with it, but normally, right. Normally the counterintuitive requires more. If the penalty is a significant amount, then normally the counterintuitive will be disfavored.
Yeah, but we are not probably on this level.
Okay. So
we started with stirrup and then
no.
So stirrup is kind of problematic.
The pulse areas here. So as far as I understood, you have weak fields. It's weak fields. So it doesn't matter pulse shaping. Interpretation theory, so the pulse shaping is not really important. It doesn't matter. So two or three. No, I mean this is perturbation, right? The 10% of population goes, even less.
Why shouldn't it have something to do
because with the Fourier transform of B squared?
And if it does have to do with the Fourier transform of B squared, then it's going to depend on the phase of B.
I agree.
So the perturbation, it's important with the pulse shaping?
Yeah, for the reason that Phil says it's a two-photon
process. In perturbation theory, so it's only in energy or intensity.
But it's second order.
Yes, but it's energy, right?
The phase turns out phase matters.
Phase matters.
It's a second order coherent process. So phase of one matters, the other matters. Well, that's.
Okay.
I think we should.
Yeah, I should wrap up. So.
So what were you going to say there?
Well, so yeah, there's other optimization schemes, but we're kind of already talking about them. So to use a counterintuitive pulse sequence, just quickly, they've been trying it using the multi-configurational time-dependent Hartree-Fock and Bill McCurdy's lab, and there's a lot of states involved, so it seems to not be, it doesn't seem to work to use like stirrup type schemes. Infrared mixing of virtual states, we've talked about a little bit. And then also we could analyze the flux terms through the ionization threshold in order to change our update formulas. Okay. And then also quickly, I just wanted to mention that we have these tools. Maybe we could also control high harmonic generation with the same sort of optimal numerical calculations. You have to formulate your cost functionals in Fourier space, but the same sort of cost functionals where you reduce ionizations can improve bulk harmonic generation because you'd be eliminating the plasma that's formed, and so you'd make it easier to do phase matching. And then maybe you could even control the light fields that are created by your high harmonics by controlling the fundamental field that you use to generate them. So in conclusion, to describe nonlinear XUV and X-ray processes, you need to carefully consider the level of electronic structure you're using. With the TDCIS method, we show that channel coupling is important in high harmonic generation for sure. The effects of electron correlation remain to be seen. It should be noted that all the optimization tools that we've generated can be fairly easily moved up to higher levels of theory, and even lower levels of theory too, if we want to describe larger processes. And preliminary optimal controls calculations suggest that we can suppress ionization by a few orders of magnitude, at least by shaping these pulses and optimization analysis of these pulses. Is our next step. So a few acknowledgments, of course, Brigitte Whaley. Christiana Koch set me up with the Krotoff method and taught me about it. Daniel Reich and Michael Goertz set me up with the code, and Daniel's been helping me debug it over the past week. It's been fun. I built the TDCIS method with Robin Santra, who was at Argonne and now is in Hamburg at DAISY. Stefan Pops, Fejo, and Antonia are his students who are kind of the stewards of the code now. David Mazziotti was my undergrad advisor and also worked with us on developing the TDCIS method with Thomas and Eugene. And the experiments, the atom interferometry experiments and the laser setups are a collaboration with Holger Mueller and Ali Belgesem at Berkeley and at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. So thanks.
Yeah, I
can. All right, let's have first. Let me ask the classical question, which everybody always torments me with, which is, what about robustness of your optimal pulses?
Nothing about them right now, but okay. In the future.
That's a very easy motion. So you ask Tomas.
I thought you were going to say, why aren't we doing this with crap?
It's obvious it should be.
Isn't that crap TM? That's why we can't use it.
No, you can. We can license it.
He wants everything to be crap. Yeah. So you have a crop of crap at one point, right?
Well, it's still in competition because crap is not gradient based. Eh? So,
yeah. All right. Any other questions?
May I ask you another question? So when you start comparison with unshaped pulse or the first guess pulse. So I mean, this is kind of unfavorable case. So why you can start from the longer time scale? Because it's kind of obvious you need more time, right?
Yeah, that definitely improves things by not necessarily an order of magnitude. I've done the calculations, I didn't show them. I didn't do the optimal calculations in a longer time scale, just to make things easy on me to start off with. But yeah, as you decrease the bandwidth of your pulses, you do improve by maybe a factor of 3 or something like that. It's not, it's nothing compared to the shaping.
And if you plot, let's say, your best outcome as function of pulse energy, what would be your curve?
I can't answer that. I don't know it off the top of my head.
A few points, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the energies are changing very little here, so I think it would be you wouldn't say fairly vertical, but slightly compared to, yeah. But I don't know is the real answer.
Also, you haven't got the best calculation. You haven't got the best pulses yet. This is still an ongoing optimization.
No, I'm just curious. So, what is?
So you want to plot?
What's
the best?
Best your results as function of
so
pulse energy.
Best population, the population as a function of pulse energy.
I don't know. I could do it.
I believe it's going to be linear, dependent.
I think it would be pretty close to linear.
So if it deals with this, then the population is
safe.
Right? But it's obvious, no?
We should talk about it a bit more. I mean, we certainly think.
I would have said no before like 2 days ago, but looking at the pulses that we did get out, I don't know. I think it's worth considering.
No, it's great. I like it, but in a sense, this would be my first choice to check.
Mm-hmm.
And a question about Krotov, so it doesn't give you any troubles in terms of imaginary part of this stuff?
No. I mean, the troubles were in debugging, but not in. I mean, so it. Actually, no. I should rephrase. To start off with, no. But then, as the energy of the pulse increases, then we do run into what I think is numerical noise, due to the imaginary parts. Yeah. So the answer is not yet.
I had a lot of troubles with this. So mm-hmm.
Well, usually if you have first order equation of motions, then the imaginary part will not matter at all. I mean, it's just something that you have to simulate properly as an equation of motion that has imaginary time propagation. If you do that properly from an algorithmical point of view, having an imaginary part will only give you trouble if you have a non-linear equation of motion with respect to the states. You have a linear equation of motion with respect to the state that is non-emission. This is usually not a problem from a purely algorithmical point of view, as long as you are able to simulate it.
So in a sense, you're telling me that it's linear interaction with atoms?
No, the equation of motion is linear with respect to the states, which just means that you can write it as operator times state.
So a couple of things. One, I think when we include the complex part of the potential is important.
Sure, yeah. In this case.
In the linear case, actually, the imaginary part is, from an algorithmical point of view, you can prove that not a problem at all.
OK, this is what we have. I mean, I think we did a lot of numerical calculations in the TDCAS development stage. And where we include the complex potential really affected the numerics of the problem. So that might also be an issue. But then, yeah, we do have we do have linear equations of motion, so it hasn't. I don't think it's an issue. One more comment about perturbation theory. A lot of the control calculations I showed were done with states that can be reached using one photon. So I got rid of all the TDCS states that you couldn't reach with one photon from the ground state, and then those pulses worked in the full. The full TDCIS calculation. So I do think it's really worth considering perturbation theory.
One quick question. How many of these overhauls are
you? So because we have atoms, we can take advantage of a lot of symmetry, but there is somewhere in the neighborhood of like 60,000 basis functions. And yeah, so that's about how many. That's how many orbitals we have, and then how many states we have. We use a lot of cutoffs, but you know.
But in your control set calculations, how many orbitals do you need? You expanded your wave function in terms of your
orbitals. We expanded the wave function in terms of the states. So in the control calculations, I included something like 60 states for the simple control calculations, and I've done calculations where I had a few hundred states. In the control calculations?
Yeah, because when there's a different state, they're the
many electron states. There are many electron states. I guess now we have a proliferation. David.
So you didn't really show any sexy movies of electron moving under these pulses.
Mm-hmm.
And principally you could because you have the orbitals. So. Would there be anything to be learned by looking at the time evolution?
I think certainly, yeah. I mean, I've done no analysis of the pulses whatsoever. They're like a day old or something like that. So, the movie making is part of the XCID code. It's called the TDCIS code that is in its current edition at DAISY. So, yeah, movies are. Sexy movies will be part of the future.
Here's some money.
So then, why Krotov with respect to other gradient-based methods? Have you checked what GRAPE would do? Why did you choose it in the first place?
Chose it because I went to Germany, and they are good at Krotov, and they taught me how to use it. So that's why I chose it.
There are other aglets in Germany.
The People's Republic of all.
One could, but if you have one method that works and you don't really want to go around.
No, of course, no, but I'm happy because I was using Krotov for a long time.
Yes.
And in a series of problems, I found out it worked better. And then there was this work that Sophie did that maybe Krotov converges in the beginning, but maybe GRAPE is better afterwards. And then Daniel and Christiane have done the second order Krotov. And so it's interesting to collect evidence for cases. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, maybe Krotov second order works better anyway. So it would be exciting to know that for me. Okay, so but if it was more than an anecdotal, the reason you chose it, then it would have been interesting.
But the fidelity issue, or the populations are so low that I wouldn't be able to say anything. It's tiny populations. Usually I'm used to, I would have a yield at least maybe 90%, but here the excited state populations are just very, very low, so I'm not sure.
But it's not finished yet. Right,
and really optimized. So I'm thinking that we never really did any comparison of algorithms in a regime where you had.
So convergence always in a regime where you have like 99.9.
Yeah, typically, I mean.
And it converges very, very quickly. So which is why, I mean, those are toy problems for me. And this is instead a really difficult problem. And so that is where it's interesting for me to see whether, you know, there are no second order cutoff, does better, what are the advantages. And this is not general, but it is one specific instance that there
is. This is first order, yeah.
The second order, you've done a nonlinear.
Right, but in principle, it's the second order extension can be also used for standard problems as an additional numerically adaptive.
Okay, so you are not yet using the second order.
No.
Okay.
But you don't do a Newton type of, you don't use second order gradient information.
No, not really. You use the history of the optimization to actually make it such that the Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equations are approximately fulfilled. It's a bit complicated. We don't yet understand why it actually can speed up convergence, but in some example we have seen that it can do it.
Because we have this thing which we call KBFGS, which is
right.
This is something else, which is exactly right.
This operates on top of it actually. It's split. Right now I'm really talking about the second order parameter, the sigma, that can be also used to increase
the for the nonlinear shortage.
Yes, there it is needed to be monotonic convergent, but if you're monotonic convergent anyways, you can use it still to try to speed up convergence. And on top of that you can use this KLRBFGS to basically adjust the 1/λ in front of the whole gradient to speed up convergence. This is independent from each other, this is orthogonal things if you want.
We need more letters in the
alphabet. MCT, DHV, and VFTS.
On that note, let's thank Laura again for.